Can God use only good people for missional purposes? Hello, welcome to Good Word. I am David Thomas, your host again today. We are in the middle of a series of discussions running all 13 weeks, looking at various stories in the Bible from which we draw missional implications. We have reflected on the fact that when the world fell into sin, that God became missional in his desire of saving the world, or restoring it, and in doing that, the missional purposes of God are distributed. And so we've been looking at different people like Abraham and Jonah and so forth, and today we come to a very interesting and complicated story about Esther and Mordecai. My conversation partners today are Brant Berglund and Paul Dibdall, two good colleagues from the School of Theology. Now, Paul and Brant, in our own conversations, we have mentioned how complicated this story is, but maybe between the three of us, we could sketch out some pertinent details. And people can read this, listeners can read this in its entirety, Esther, the book of Esther. But what are some pertinent details that we should pull in here, remembering that we're going to be looking for some missional outcome along the way?
The story begins with a king who has a wife who does not do exactly as he asks. And so he sends her away and begins to seek a new woman, a new queen. And Esther is an orphan girl who is under the care of her relative, Mordecai, and she is one of the prospective new queens.
So she enters a
kind of
a beauty contest.
Kind of a contest to see who will take the place of the deposed queen.
She's also there as a foreigner. Her family are Israelites in a foreign nation with a Greek.
So you're telling me that a believer is vying for, that strikes me as a bit odd that if she's a devout person, why is she involved in a beauty contest?
Well, people, apparently it was not widely known, her background, her religious background. So she has accommodated herself. How should we say it? She has enculturated herself in such a way that she is not understood to be or known to be a Jew, apparently. Yeah.
And the contest is a questionable one. You know, we sometimes have a picture of Esther being a beautiful and pure woman, and yet when she goes into the king, she comes out the next day and goes to a different part of the house that they call the harem, and that gives us a little different picture of who Esther is.
And so anyway, the story unfolds and there comes a point of crisis, doesn't there? And by the way, I'm not trying to shy away from that. I do think that whoever wrote this wrote it somewhat euphemistically to mask some of those hard realities that you talk about, that the whole idea of an Eastern king with a harem is very normal in those societies.
Very much.
But it's quite horrifying to people who are not in those. And so, as you said, Paul, she is enculturated here and may not have been a person at that point of great faith. She may have been somebody who didn't really understand the faith of her father. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, I think that's possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, the greatest among us, there's always a development over the course of our life, and I think we sometimes don't allow that in our Bible heroes, because certainly Esther has some tremendous qualities, and that's what we usually emphasize, which we probably should. But I think it's – if we read the text of Scripture, I think we can see that again, our greatest heroes, they do grow along the way. They're not perfect.
Yeah,
not perfect people.
But I am intrigued by this idea that she may have been a person who, because of her being an orphan and being raised in a foreign place, may not have known very much about her own faith system, and certainly not about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so I would imagine if that were the case, that winning the beauty contest was a great achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And, as the story goes on, we discover that eventuality becomes a kind of a a providence, as it were, because it creates, it puts her in a place where at a moment of crisis, she's able to act.
Mm-hmm.
See, you want to reflect on what brought about the moment of crisis, anybody? I know it's a complicated story, but
it is complicated. But her cousin Mordecai would sit at the city gate, and at one point he overheard a plot to overthrow the king, and he made the plot known, and the culprits were caught. But he was never honored. And at a later point in the story, the king can't sleep, and he reads the record, the history. He has the chronicles read, and he hears about Mordecai, and he says, was anything ever done to honor this man who saved me? No, king, nothing was ever done. Well, in that case, somebody should do something to help Mordecai be known. And he calls on one of his counselors, Haman, who already had a problem with Mordecai because Mordecai would not bow to him when he was out and about.
Yeah.
And so Mordecai is going to be honored, and Haman is the man who is going to honor him. The king says, Haman, what would you recommend? You're one of my advisors. What would you recommend we do for this man? He says, for somebody whom the Lord wishes to honor. And Haman thinks it's about himself at first. Oh, what would I like more than to be led around on the king's own horse, with the king's own saddle, with the king's own robe and crown, and to be treated like royalty, and to have someone go ahead and say, this is what will be done for the king, for the one whom the king wishes to honor. And then the king utters the ironic words in the narrative, go and make it so, and do so for Mordecai, the man who will not bow to you. And so we see the tables turning.
Yeah, yeah. But there's more to the story, right? Because there comes this moment of the potential destruction of the Jews. Yeah, right?
Haman cannot stand the Jews, and he recognizes in Mordecai one of them, and so he seeks to pass a congressional law that the Jews will be put to death.
Yeah, that allows the public execution, the elimination of them. And here's where actually the story of Esther begins to emerge, right, Paul?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her relative Mordecai comes to her and says, basically, we need help. Your people are in danger. And Esther, I don't want to get in trouble with my listeners who've kind of idolized Esther, but when I read the story in the text, it seems to me as though Esther needs a little bit of prodding from Mordecai.
So. I think so.
She's hesitant.
She's hesitant, and Mordecai says, look, don't think that you're going to escape this. so he does press her just a bit.
Yeah.
And then there are words, courageous words, beautiful words. She sets aside some time for fasting, and then she says, I'll go before the king, even knowing that if she was not favorably received, she could die.
Yeah,
but she
says,
I'll go before the king. If I perish, I perish.
Yeah.
And Mordecai's words, you know, maybe Esther, you've been put into this situation for such a time as this.
Yeah, yeah.
So those are the two, kind of the crux of the story for many.
And I like what you said there, Paul, because I agree with you. I don't think Esther is really warmed up to this idea when it's first proposed to her, because a person could not just waltz in to see the king, you know, and the way you went in and whether you were received well or not could be a life or death matter. And so, you know, I think your assessment of that is correct, that she's not excited about this, saying, oh, yeah, I'll just go in and see the king and we'll take care of this. That she is afraid, and yet somehow in her mind there arises a sense of obligation that trumps her desire for personal safety. And I like the fact that you recited those words. She said, I will go. Mm-hmm. I will go. And we hear people often quoting, perhaps you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this.
Yeah. Right.
And so, you know, the beauty pageant, as it were, becomes the foundation upon which the opportunity rests.
And it says that, again, just like he found her initially when she first was introduced to him, it says when she comes in before him that the king found favor, or she found favor in his sight.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have here an intercessor. We have a mediator between the king and the people. And we know that some have noticed a type, a symbol of Jesus in here as well in this intercessing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting, she doesn't tell the king immediately what the deal is. She invites him to a banquet, as I recall, right?
Yeah.
And then, but doesn't say anything at the banquet, has to have a second banquet.
Yes. Well, she invites Haman to both of them well.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then points him out as a scoundrel, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the king makes a law that the Jews can defend themselves or something to that effect.
Uh-huh.
And so Where's the missional story in here, gentlemen?
I'll try something which maybe is not the most clear missional application, but I think it's fairly well known, but still surprising that in the book of Esther, there's no mention of God.
Yeah.
There's no mention of prayer. I was very careful when I said Esther set aside 3 days of
fasting.
It's fasting in the text. No prayer is mentioned. So the overt terminology, overt religious language is not present in the book of Esther. And I think that speaks there should be an important lesson here for us, and this is for me, maybe quickly getting to the punchline. That is that I think in many of our experiences, our lives are a little bit messy, kind of like Esther's is. We've already said, was she totally pure? Did she really understand all the details of her religion? Should she have stood up against the king more like Daniel and his three friends did? She kind of seemed to go along with things. And we don't hear about her prayer like we hear about Daniel's prayer and all of that.
Yeah, she's not praying every day toward Jerusalem.
Right.
Yeah,
we don't have that in the text. And yet, when you read the book, what you somehow understand is that God has somehow been present in the messiness of it all to bring about his will. His will is accomplished in spite of all this kind of messiness. And that, I think, is a hopeful kind of message for us. We don't see the sea parted. You know, why couldn't we all have the grand miracle? Sometimes we complain about not seeing those. That doesn't mean God isn't present, and it doesn't mean God isn't at work. He is.
In fact, Israel recognized that, and they established one of their yearly festivals, Purim, based on the experience of being saved by Esther, a book that, like you mentioned, doesn't speak of God at all, has become one of the greatest Jewish festivals of their calendar year.
Yeah, what I like in the story is the growth of missional conviction in Esther. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that, you know, just as adversity can cause people to want to become open to the leading of God, adversity or a tight spot can also produce missional intent. You know, and I think she reached deep down and new realizations came to her that here was an opportunity that had with it a sense of responsibility that she decided she would not back away from, mm-hmm. and results in the saving of her people. I wonder the effect of her witness on the king and on other people in her time. I don't know if there's anything to talk about there. But anyway, a wonderful story. I appreciate your slightly unorthodox observations, because I do think that we read the story euphemistically, and yet here in the moment of crisis, Esther steps up and serves with great missional capacity, and I think that's really the point that we want to take with us. So thank you very much, Paul and Brent, for your contributions today. My thanks also to David Olson, our engineer. And my thanks to those of you who listen to Good Word, whom we hear far and wide. For Good Word, I'm Dave Thomas.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.